with your.
Okay.
Okay, thanks, Freya.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you, Andy, for your service. Really, really appreciate it. I'll start my timer. My name is Freya. I am a recovered compulsive eater and bulimic and a chaos creator, controller fixer, Al-Anonic, and I don't use the word recovered yet, but I'm like, but I'm not how I used to be. So I don't know. I'm on the way. And I'm in Colorado, and so glad to be with you guys. I really love this meeting and love seeing your faces. So it's a big honor and privilege to get to be sharing something that feels really near and dear to my heart. And I was speaking at a different meeting in a different fellowship earlier this week, and I left feeling like I didn't share something, like just not feeling good about it. And I realized later it's because I wasn't sharing about the work that I'm currently really in, which is this stuff. And so I was so excited, I'm so excited that I get to be sharing about what feels really, really current, really valuable, really like where God is right now. So, my topic is, the chapter more about alcoholism and specifically about the mental obsession, which is apparently the worst part of our disease, the part that kills us. And the reason is because I am currently in a workshop, and that's what we're working on. So that was that. That's why I chose that. And I'm not going to go through the entire chapter because I just don't have time. But I do want to hit on a few things that just feel really significant for me. I've read this many, many times. Every time I read through it, whether it's with taking someone else through or myself, I always get more, and my book fills up with more and more notes. And so I can't share it all, but I'm going to share what I felt inspired to share today. So here goes. So the chapter three, if you want to follow along, I'll try to reference pages. It starts on page 30, more about alcoholism. And I've also been told that it's more about the mental obsession. And I guess I'm wondering if I should just try to do a really quick brief intro of why I'm here. I'll make it really quick. Or how I got here is that I had long-term participation in Overeaters Anonymous. And while I was, recovering in that program, my controlling, fixing, managing was through the roof. I didn't realize that was like what I turned to because it seemed to be working so well. And I reached a point where I, the food was so not the problem. The food was so down, and I was so crazy, and I needed a solution. And I had, been going to Al-Anon. And so I dug into Al-Anon thinking that'll do it. And then, and that was great, and it was helpful. And that, and I wanted my quest for a message of depth and weight led me to the Big Book Awakening. And where I'm really hearing like, this is what's going on with me. Like, this is really what my problem is. Because when I read some of the other literature, they have these awesome ideas, but there's this, at least I interpret it. I don't think this is probably the message being given, but I interpret it as, do it yourself, do it on your own power. Like this idea of like detach with love, let go, great ideas. How important is it that those are awesome ideas, but I just couldn't do them on my own power. And I wasn't being, it wasn't being explicitly, at least I wasn't receiving it. So anyway, that's how I got here and why. And the message that I get here is really, really clearly, you don't have any power. And I'm finally able to hear it, because while I'm controlling and fixing and managing, it's like, well, wait a second, I'm making things happen. How can you say I don't have power? Like I'm doing this. So anyway, so that's where I come from. So jumping into this chapter, more about alcoholism. It's really important for me to understand that I have the physical allergy piece and the mental obsession piece and the spiritual malady piece. That's all the parts of step one. And, coming in as a chaos creator, controller, fixer, the physical allergy can be tricky to wrap your brain around, but I'm not going to spend a lot of time on that, but just this idea that I respond differently when I engage in certain behaviors or even thoughts. And then the mental obsession part is telling me that, no, I can do it this time. And I like to really, I think we spend a lot of time on the physical allergy and maybe not as much on the mental obsession, really understanding what it is, because as a controller, fixer, obsessor, like obsessing is something I do. And so to get really clear, what do they mean about the mental obsession? It doesn't mean, oh, I just obsess. You know, I think what this book is referring to is what they call the mental twist or the mental blank spot. So it's that it's this part of my brain that says, you can do it this time. It's going to be different this time. It's going to work this time. If you do it differently this time, it's going to be fine. You're justified because of this. So I think it's really, really important to know and identify what is my mental obsession. And I was listening to, I think it was like Joe Hawk and Mark Houston, and they were saying, don't go past, you know, like page, whatever it is, page 23, if you don't get the physical allergy, and don't go past page 43, if you don't get the mental obsession. So it's really important that I understand that stuff. Because as it says, it is the cunning, baffling, powerful aspect of my disease. Like the physical allergy is bad, but the mental obsession is what's going to kill me, or mental blank spot, if you will. So I'm going to go to page, you know, page 30 and 31, they say none of us have been willing, you know, most of us are not willing to admit that we have this thing. And so when I read these pages and I'm nodding and saying, yep, yep, me too, I realize that thinking that I don't have this is actually a symptom of the disease. So guess what? If I think I don't have this, I probably have this. So that always makes me chuckle. And then that list on 31 of, here are some of the methods we've tried. I'm going to share how I've adapted it. My list is actually quite long, so I might not read the whole thing. But here are some of the methods that I have tried to think, control, fix, manage like other people. Giving practical advice or giving advice only when requested. Limiting the number of interactions. Never obsessing alone, never checking my phone in the morning, creating chaos only at home, never losing it in front of my children, never meddling during business hours, gossiping only at parties, switching from raging to sweetly requesting, thinking only helpful thoughts, agreeing to resign if I ever yell at my kids, and then the rest of it I don't have to change, taking a trip, not taking a trip, swearing off forever with and without a solemn oath, taking more physical exercise, reading inspirational books, going to retreats and meetings, accepting voluntary commitment to 12-step programs and workshops. We could increase the list ad infinitum. And I'm going to increase the list by saying, avoiding people, places, and situations, trying a new approach to the steps, getting a new sponsor, going to more or less meetings, doing more or less projects, doing more 10 steps, spending more or less time with family, doing more or less service, et cetera. So thinking, oh, if I try this, if I try that, if I try this, if I try that. So those are some of the methods I have tried. And I'm just looking at my time. There's a couple of tests in here. Like it's really important that I diagnose myself. So they have a couple of tests. They say, go out and try to do something, you know, and for me, it's go out and make a, you know, make a helpful suggestion to someone you love, and then try it more than one, you know, try to do it and then stop abruptly. Like, hey, to my husband, like, do you want to try this? Or maybe you could do this, and then walk away and let it go. Can I do that? Maybe once in a while I can do that, but try it more than once. Can I do that on a regular basis? What does my experience show me? And something that's so important for me to recognize is that my first behavior is not actually really unreasonable. Like for a normal person, just like an alcoholic, you know, like a normal person taking a drink is not really an insane thing to do. So it's not really insane for me to want to make a helpful comment, except in the light of what always happens. The consequences are I trigger my physical allergy and I can't put it down. So that is really important for me, because someone looking up from the outside is like, well, what was wrong with that? You know, like, you made a comment, you made a helpful suggestion, you were trying to be helpful. There's nothing wrong with that. There's my 10 minute timer. Do five more. And, but I just need to look at my experience and know where it takes me. So it is insane for me to pick that stuff up. I wanted to read my adaptation of the Jaywalker if I have time here. So I'm just going to go ahead and do that, because the Jaywalker is, they offer a lot of illustrations in this chapter. First, the man of 30 who thinks I can put it down. And now, since I put it down for so long, now I can pick it up and use it normally. And then the Jaywalker. So my, if you go to the page 37 on the last paragraph, I'm skipping past Jim. Sorry, Jim. This is my adaptation of the Jaywalker. Our behavior, my behavior, is as absurd and incomprehensible with respect to the first obsessive thought as that of an individual with a passion, say, for jaywalking. She gets a thrill out of trying to be perfect and thinking she knows what is best for everyone. She enjoys herself for a few years in spite of friendly warnings that perfection is not possible or even desirable. Up to this point, you would label her as a foolish woman having unrealistic ideas of success. Luck then deserts her and her loved ones withdraw and resist her management several times in succession. You would expect her, if she were normal, to learn to accept others as they are and stop trying to control them. Presently, she interprets her family members' normal behavior as a big problem that she needs to fix, and this time creates chaos by trying to fix, manage, and control every aspect of their home life, which drives them all further away from her. Within a week after making amends, an annoyance over her husband's behavior causes her to give him advice again. She tells you she has decided to stop controlling for good. But in a few weeks, she again insists that she needs to tell her family what to do and feels completely justified and wronged when they resist her. On through the years, this conduct continues, accompanied by her continual promises to pause, pray, and do a 10th step before making a comment or losing her temper. Finally, she can no longer think anything but obsessive thoughts. Her husband withdraws, her children don't want to be around her. She tries every known means to get the idea that she knows what is best and must manage others out of her head. She spends hours using program tools, hoping to mend her ways. But the moment she finishes her prayer and meditation, she gets annoyed and criticizes her family members, which further harms these important relationships. Such a person would be crazy, wouldn't she? So I know we all experience chaos creating in different ways, but that was my adaptation, and I found it really helpful to change the words to identify in here. So I only have a couple minutes, so I want to just close by saying, well, two things. I'll see if I can fit in two things. On 37, it says that parallel with our sound reasoning, there inevitably ran some insanely trivial excuse for taking the first obsessive thought. So I love that illustration that here's the sound reasoning. It's one line and it's totally intact. I have sound reasoning. I have rationality. But parallel to that on another line is this mental blank spot. And no matter what, when I am in the mental blank spot, it cannot touch. My sound reasoning cannot touch it. I am without defense against it. So the last thing I'll say is on page 43, at the end of Fred's story, where he is saying, he says, my old manner, it's at the top, my old manner of life was by no means a bad one, but I would not exchange its best moments for the worst I have now. I would not go back to it, even if I could. And I was discussing this in my homework group yesterday, and it was so cool to reflect on, you know, why would I not exchange the best moments in recovery for the worst? I'm sorry, the best moments before recovery to the worst in recovery. And it's because my worst moments were, my best moments, the best thing that I could come up with in my disease was getting my way, making things go, you know, making things work out. When the house was clean, the kids were behaving, my husband was doing what I thought, you know, he should do. And that I would get that temporary high of like, okay, I've arrived, the world is going my way, but it was not peaceful. It was, it was very temporary, and it just set up an appetite for more of the same. It was like, okay, tomorrow I got to get up and try to manage it all again. So it was exhausting. And today in my worst moments, when things aren't going my way, I get to pause and ask God in, and not ask God to make it go away, but just say, God, be with me in this. This sucks. I don't like this. And sooner or later, you know, it doesn't always come immediately. I get that reassurance that God's saying, hey, I've got you. I've got the situation. I've got everybody involved. I'm taking care of things, and you are getting to practice spiritual principles. And that's what this is all about. You're growing in compassion. This is all useful. This is all for a purpose. And I get that God-sized hole filled. And that is so incredibly, without a doubt, so I would not exchange that for those temporary highs that I got from everything's going my way. So with that, I will pass. And thank you for letting me share.
Thank you very much, Freya.